The U.S. has the dollar, Japan the yen, countries in the eurozone have the euro. Now, some people have come up with a currency not tied to any country or government. It's called Bitcoin, and a number of online stores now accept Bitcoins as payment. You can buy socks with them, computer equipment. One place will sell you coffee beans. David Kestenbaum and Jacob Goldstein with our Planet Money team gave the new currency a try.
Bitcoins don't actually exist in the physical world. You can't hold one in your hand. They're just on computers.
We wanted to try to buy lunch with Bitcoins. So we talked with Gavin Andreessen, a programmer who's done a lot of work on Bitcoin. He didn't actually create the Bitcoin system, though. In fact, he said there's a strange story behind that.
The idea started with a guy named Satoshi Nakamoto. He's a bit of a mysterious figure. We're not sure if Satoshi Nakamoto is his real name. I've only ever interacted with him via email.
Are you Satoshi Nakamoto?
I am not Satoshi Nakamoto.
Whoever Satoshi Nakamoto is came up with a pretty clever system. Everybody who uses Bitcoin has a digital wallet. And when you buy something, you send your Bitcoins to someone else's wallet. It's what computer geeks call a peer-to-peer system.
There's no center to the whole thing. It's not like there's one computer somewhere storing all the information. The system is run by everybody. Bitcoin is money backed by the people who use it, independent of any government. For Gavin Andreessen, that's a big part of the appeal.
For me, that's more comforting than thinking that politicians or central bankers won't screw it up. I actually trust the wisdom of the crowds more.
Bitcoin is a lot like cash, but an online version. There are no big fees, and transactions are anonymous. That makes it hard to know how many people are using Bitcoins, but every day, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of Bitcoins are trading in online currency exchanges.
Satoshi set up the system so that there's a finite number of Bitcoins that can ever be created. In that way, it's a bit like gold.
Gavin Andreessen says the best way for us to get some Bitcoins is to buy some. In the same way you can trade dollars for British pounds, you can also trade dollars for Bitcoins in online exchanges. So we tried that out.
When we started working on this story, $7 got you one Bitcoin. But when we went to the exchange, something crazy had happened. Now it says 23.8.
No.
So what, 2 weeks ago? It was 7.
What? So it's Wait, is that right or is it flipped or something?
No, price per coin in dollars.
This was part of a wild few weeks for Bitcoin. The website Gawker ran a story about an online market where you could use Bitcoins to buy heroin, LSD, and other illegal drugs. After that story ran, the exchange rate for Bitcoins started rocketing up.
Then someone posted online that they'd had $500,000 worth of Bitcoins stolen.
A few days later, the main Bitcoin exchange website got hacked and had to shut down for a while. So we couldn't buy Bitcoins there.
We called Gavin Andreessen back to ask him if there was some other way.
Oh, you guys are in New York City?
Yes.
I mean, if you're physically in New York City, the fastest way to get Bitcoins is to find somebody else in New York City who's willing to sell you Bitcoins for cash, and then you meet them in person and you give them some cash, and then they transfer Bitcoins to you. It's primitive, but that's the best you can do right now if you want to get Bitcoins quickly.
Gavin gave us the name of a guy who was actually just 10 blocks away. Bruce Wagner.
Hi, look for Bruce Wagner.
I'm Bruce Wagner.
Bruce Wagner, it turns out, hosts this online TV show about Bitcoin.
Every day, we talk about Bitcoin for an hour. There's so much to talk about. And then that's the Bitcoin show. And then we have, in Spanish language, El Show de Bitcoin on Wednesdays. That's weekly.
We sit in Bruce Wagner's office where he has two computers. He has me go to this website, My Bitcoin, to set up an account. But when I go there, it shows an enormous account balance. It turns out the person who sat there before me forgot to log out.
Someone else was using that computer.
So whoever this person is has a lot of Bitcoins.
Yeah, a lot of people come and go through here.
25,000 Bitcoins worth $426,000, it says.
Bruce Wagner said that money was not his. He wouldn't say how many Bitcoins he has, but he clearly feels like they're a good investment. Last year, these things were worth pennies.
I signed up for an account at My Bitcoin. All I had to do was create a username and password. I didn't have to provide my name or any other personal information. Then I gave Bruce $40 in cash, and he looked up the exchange rate.
That comes out, on my calculator, to 2.35294116. You might wonder why we go that many decimal places, and the reason is because we expect that Bitcoin one day could be worth $100,000 of Bitcoin. So those decimal places will matter in the future. Now watch this. I hit send payment. And now hit view balance and see if you see it there.
Oh, there it is. My account balance is 2.352941117 bitcoins. Yeah.
We had our bitcoins, but before we used them, we had an important question. Are they legal? Can you just create and use some new currency?
We called Ronald Mann at Columbia Law School, and he said it is legal for now. If it turns out bitcoins are used mostly for illegal stuff, the government could shut the whole thing down.
If you put something out on the internet as a payment system, what you have to observe as a regulator is what are the things that it's useful for. Okay, and if its main attraction is that it's wholly anonymous, that's not something that ordinary consumers care about. The main people that are really excited about a wholly anonymous payment system are people that are violating the law.
And there is this thing called the Stamp Payments Act, which prohibits the creation of private money.
Now, the statute's very old. It hasn't been applied or interpreted by a court in more than 100 years. So what it would mean in the modern context is very hard to say.
But Ronald Mann said Bitcoin faces a much more basic challenge. For it to take off, a critical mass of people has to prefer using bitcoins to using dollars.
That's why I see its future as a real currency as being very limited.
What do you think bitcoin will be like in, I don't know, 5 years or 10 years?
Oh, I think it won't exist.
Won't exist. In which case, early adopters like Bruce Wagner could find their bitcoins one day worth nothing.
We used our bitcoins to buy lunch, which you can do in Midtown Manhattan at Meze Grill. There's even a sign in the window.
Bitcoin accepted here.
We got smoothies. Jacob, you got the falafel platter. I got the chicken platter.
Rice falafel, bulgur wheat, sir.
Bulgur wheat, please.
At the cash register, it took me a few minutes to log in on my iPhone and send my bitcoins to the restaurant, but eventually it worked.
The owner says he gets a handful of people paying in bitcoins every day. I'm David Kestenbaum.
And I'm Jacob Goldstein, NPR News.
Okay, after our reporters bought their lunch, My Bitcoin, the online bank they used, was robbed and had to shut down. Bruce Wagner, who hosts the online show about Bitcoin, says he lost tens of thousands of dollars worth of Bitcoins.
These days, the demand for corn seems insatiable. The ethanol industry, livestock, and export markets can't get enough. When a recent USDA report predicted lower yields than previously expected, prices spiked even higher. And economists say demand will likely continue to exceed supply for some time. As Harvest Public Media's Kathleen Masterson reports, all of this has some investors treating corn like the new gold.
On a recent sun-beaten afternoon, I'm traveling with two corn buyers from Heartland Co-op in Des Moines to Vernon Flynn's farm just outside of town. They're visiting to check the crop's progress. For a more accurate estimate, you need to check the corn away from the edge of the field. So we wrestle our way through the towering 8-foot corn stalks, shielding our faces to keep from being cut by the sharp leaves. Flynn twists off an ear of corn to examine how the heat has damaged it.
That one there is kind of a nose back, probably due to dry weather. This ear is probably 16 rows around, and it looks like there's probably 4 or 5 kernel rows right there in that row that's aborted or will not fill.
Still, when they measure the ears and count kernels back at the pickup, Flynn estimates a pretty decent crop, about 170 bushels per acre, compared to 153 projected nationally. Farmers planted far more acres of corn this year, so even though flooding and drought lowered yield per acre estimates, harvest time could still bring a good-sized haul. But demand from the ethanol industry, livestock feed, and export market continues to outstrip yield projections, says Iowa State University economist Chad Hart, and that sent grain prices soaring.
When you looked last summer, we had corn prices in some cases down around $3.50 a bushel. Now we're up in the $6 to $7 range, so we've seen nearly a doubling of prices, if you will, over that past 15 months.
The USDA report suggests that grain prices will stay elevated over the next year or so. Corn stockpiles are nearing a 15-year low, and soybean stockpiles have been tight for at least 4 years. And in the last few months, another player has taken a bite out of the U.S. corn market.
China's been a very early buyer of the corn crop we're growing now, and so they've already, if you will, put in some advanced purchases. And that's been something that has got the market a little worked up right now.
China bought some 21 million bushels from the U.S. in July, its biggest purchase in 15 years. Now, high grain prices are usually good news for farmers. They help Vernon Flynn buy a new tractor. But today's even higher prices mean even higher stakes. And Flynn says selling in this volatile market comes with risks.
I mean, you're kind of scared to sell it for fear you're going to miss the rally. And you're scared if you don't sell it for fear we're going to say, oh, heck, we should have sold it all last time.
Driving his truck over to the next cornfield, Flynn and corn buyers Nick Hyde and Ron Grosskreutz discuss what every farmer struggles with, enormous swings in the market.
It was a lot more fun when corn was $3 and it would move, maybe the limit was 10 cents. And if it moved 10 cents in a day, you know, that was huge.
If it moved a nickel in a day, you were looking for a meteorite.
And now they're saying corn is average this year, is this right, Ron, 22 or 23 cents a day? A day in a move? Well, unheard of.
And more traders are betting not just on gold and precious metals, but on agricultural commodities. They're speculating on corn prices for years to come. Money in corn futures is five times what it was in 2004, according to numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. That's nearly a $2 trillion market for corn alone. Farmers and traders alike are getting pretty worked up over the possibility of $8 a bushel corn. But for consumers, this market frenzy translates into higher food prices. Grocery items that rely heavily on grains like meat, butter, and eggs are likely to keep going up. And much of it traces back to corn, which may just be the emerging gold standard of agricultural commodities. For NPR News, I'm Kathleen Masterson.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. Last month, more than 200,000 homeowners faced foreclosure, and we're going to hear now about one segment of the population that is struggling at a disproportionate rate. Blacks are losing their homes much faster than whites. That's helping to push the wealth gap between blacks and whites to its widest margin in decades. To illustrate the problem, NPR's Alex Kellogg takes us to Prince George's County, Maryland. It is by far the wealthiest majority black county in the U.S., and yet, as Alex reports, it is the site of nearly 40% of homes in Maryland in some stage of foreclosure.
Eric Barron is a lawyer who spends his spare time helping people stay in their homes. But he can't drive a block in his own upscale neighborhood without passing a foreclosed property.
Right there.
Right next to your house.
Yeah.
Barron has his own law practice and is on the board of several Maryland nonprofits that help people stay in their homes. He lives in a suburb of Washington, D.C., well known as a haven for black doctors, lawyers, and well-paid government workers, among others. But like most parts of Prince George's, today even his neighborhood of up-and-comers is teeming with foreclosures. Barron drove me by a golf course full of weeds in a rich subdivision near his.
When you live in a golf course community and the golf course is in foreclosure, it's a huge problem.
It's a huge problem that's just gaining momentum in Prince George's. The county's foreclosure crisis was already bad, but it got far worse late last year and hasn't eased up. Many people who live here are wealthy blacks who moved out of a poorer and more dangerous D.C. in the 80s and 90s. At the time, Prince George's was majority white. Today, it's about two-thirds black.
It's one of the few counties in the country where it's become more affluent as it's become blacker.
That's Bill Sermons, research director at the Center for Responsible Lending. He says as many as one in four black Americans who bought just before the housing crisis could lose their homes. That's a far higher ratio than whites. And because blacks tend to have more wealth tied up in their homes, they typically fall further down the economic ladder when they lose them. Sermon says that's part of the reason the black-white wealth gap is the highest it's been since the mid-80s. Before the recession, blacks were making slow but steady gains on whites. In recent years, those gains have not just been eroded, but erased.
Seeing that rate of foreclosure in Prince George's County does represent a problem for the whole nation, what it means for our middle-class African-American communities.
What it means is even some better-off blacks are slipping into poverty. Blacks are also far more likely to have been pushed into a subprime mortgage than whites, and are more likely to have a higher interest rate on a home loan than even a white person with a similar income and credit history. That's part of the reason Prince George's is hurting. More bad loans were handed out here than in any other part of the state. And more mortgage fraud cases have been convicted here than anywhere else in Maryland.
I guess that was the biggest hurt of all. You know, when you build up something and then all of a sudden you lose it. Yeah, it takes a toll on you.
Clyde Jackson wasn't a victim of predatory lending. He didn't get duped into accepting a high interest rate or an adjustable one. He was just unlucky. His wife took a pay cut several years ago, and then suddenly they couldn't afford their three-bedroom home.
Because of the strain that it began to put on me, after fighting with Wells Fargo, it was like I just had to let it go, because the longer I fought with it, try to deal with it, the more of a headache it was beginning to be.
So he walked away. He lost his home in December. He and his wife had already separated, and he was forced to move into a smaller, two-bedroom apartment. His 16-year-old son and 18-year-old daughter had to share a room for months. He says the home that he left vacant is still empty, and these empty homes are piling up. People across the county say the growing number of vacant homes chips away at Prince George's luster. But that doesn't mean people here like talking about home loss. They don't. In fact, it's a very taboo subject. Eric Barron says many here think the area doesn't get the retail stores, the public services, or even the recognition that nearby wealthy white suburbs do.
When you compare the kind of development, businesses, tax base that those areas have as compared to Prince George's, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Back on our drive, Barron said what also doesn't make sense is people here too often refusing to seek help. Residents say that's because Black Americans tend to be more private, and here in Prince George's, more prideful. Alex Kellogg, NPR News, Washington.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. The federal budget problem has gotten a little bit better. That's according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which released a new report today. The CBO estimates that this year's deficit will hit about $1.3 trillion. That's a huge amount of red ink, but it's also slightly less red ink than last year. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports on the new numbers and what they mean.
There are so many ways to describe the new picture sketched by the Congressional Budget Office report. You could say this year the U.S. government will spend $1.3 trillion more than it will take in. That's bad news for the debt. You could say the budget deal lawmakers reached earlier this summer cuts deficits nearly in half over the coming decade. That would be good news. The CBO expects unemployment to stay above 8% until 2014. Clearly bad news. But the CBO also expects the economy to keep recovering and not dip down again. So good news. All of those statements are in the report and taken altogether leave the economic forecast cloudy. The director of the Congressional Budget Office is Doug Elmendorf. He was upbeat at times today, talking to reporters in a CBO conference room. He said the debt ceiling deal lawmakers made before their August recess made a real difference, cutting more than $2 trillion from future deficits.
That is a very substantial amount of money, even by the standards of the current federal budget.
So the big picture looks a little better, says Elmendorf, but look a little closer and...
A great deal of the pain of this economic downturn still lies ahead of us.
A big part of the problem, he says, is that having the economy set on idle or very slow growth is a waste. The U.S. economy is huge, Elmendorf says, and could be producing a lot more than it is. Economists call this a loss in economic output.
Moreover, those losses are not shared evenly. They are borne very disproportionately by people who lose their jobs or have businesses fail or are thrown out of their homes.
Now, the CBO believes part of the reason the economy seems to be dropping off again is that the government stimulus package passed in the early days of the Obama administration is waning. More conservative budget measures are taking its place, and that austerity means less money flowing into the economy, fewer dollars for state and local governments, and more public sector layoffs around the country. Elmendorf says Congress could reverse those things by cutting taxes or increasing spending in some areas, but making the economy hurt less now could make the deficit worse later. Sounds strange, Elmendorf admits, but...
It's not really a paradox. All it is reflecting is that economic policy by the government has different effects under different economic conditions.
It's all about timing. It would be possible, says Elmendorf, to finely tune economic policies so that they help Americans now and later by stimulating spending in the short term and then slowly enacting measures to rein in the budget later in the decade. But that would depend on... Congress. Will Congress allow lower tax rates to expire, or will it extend them? Will lawmakers cut spending? Where And by how much? Will this summer's debt ceiling crisis lead to a new sense of urgency or more partisan gridlock? Today's report didn't have any answers to those questions. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, The Capitol.